Good afternoon, and welcome to Tech Talk. Your reader today will be William Henkel. Your articles will come from the New York Times technology section.
For our first article, Tesla's record deliveries aren't enough for investors. Tesla reported record quarterly deliveries on Wednesday, putting the electric car maker within reach of its goal for the year. But analysts remain skeptical that the company will show a profit for the period. The company said it delivered 97,000 new cars in the third quarter, a rise of almost 2% from the previous period. Production rose to 96,155 cars, a 10% increase. Tesla said that it took in a record number of net orders in the quarter, and that it was entering the fourth quarter with a growing backlog. The sales report was released after the stock market closed. Tesla's shares lost more than 4% on Thursday and are now down almost 40% from their 52-week high. Last week, Tesla's chief executive Elon Musk told employees in an email that the company had a shot at delivering more than 100,000 vehicles in the quarter, adding that demand is strong. One challenge in translating demand into profits lies in the figures for individual models. Tesla said it delivered 79,600 Model 3 sedans in the quarter, an increase of 2% from the second quarter. But deliveries of its larger, more established offerings, the Model S and the Model X, totaled 17,400, a decline of 250. Analysts say that this is a problem for Tesla, since those vehicles often sell for $90,000 and produce far more profit than the Model 3, which sells for as little as $39,000. Jeffrey Osborne of Cohen & Company said in a recent note to clients that unless Tesla cut costs enough to make money on the least expensive version of the Model 3, margins are likely to continue to be under pressure and we don't see sustainable profitability in the near to midterm. He added that Cohen saw a lot more that can go wrong that can go right. Tesla lost $408 million in the second quarter, even as it reported record deliveries and a substantial increase in revenue. Its third quarter financial report is due in the weeks ahead. So far this year, Tesla has delivered about 255,000 cars. To reach the low end of the range it has forecast for the year, 360,000 to 400,000, it will need to sell more than 100,000 in the fourth quarter. Only a slight crease in the third quarter, but a milestone has not yet achieved. Since introducing the Model S in 2012, Tesla has become one of the top producers of luxury cars in the United States, rivaling more established brands like BMW and Mercedes-Benz. But the company has yet to turn an annual profit since its founding in 2003. And automakers including Porsche, Volvo, and Audi are rolling out competing electric cars at a time when Tesla is at least a year away from the next addition to its lineup, the Model Y, a roomier version of the Model 3. Mr. Musk has promised that by next year, 1 million Tesla vehicles will be on the road, with the ability to drive themselves and operate as driverless taxis. Other automakers working on self-driving cars say it will take several more years for the technology to be put into widespread use. Tesla is also spending heavily to build a factory in China, develop an electric pickup truck, improve customer service, and expand its network of charging stations. One handicap that Tesla has faced in the United States this year resulted from its own success. Its cumulative sales reached a threshold at the end of last year that cut the federal tax credit available to buyers by half to $3,750. That figure was halved again on July 1st, and the credit will cease at the end of this year. There have also been concerns about the capabilities of Tesla's autopilot driver assist system. Last month, the National Transportation Safety Board said autopilot was at fault when a Tesla vehicle ran into a stop fire truck in California in 2018. The system was unable to immediately detect the hazard and accelerated the Tesla towards the stationary truck, the agency said. And on Wednesday, federal safety regulators said they were looking at a new Tesla feature called Smart Summon, which is supposed to enable a vehicle to navigate from a spot in a parking lot to a waiting driver. Your parked car will come find you, the company website says of the technology. But since Tesla began adding the feature to some cars in recent days through a software update, videos have appeared in social media showing crashes or near accidents while Smart Summon was in use. In a statement, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration said it was aware of reports about Smart Summon and was in ongoing contact with the company, and we continue to gather information. The agency's action was reported Wednesday afternoon by Bloomberg. And for our second article, here's how to type faster on your phone. For many of us, our approach to typing on a smartphone is something we stumble upon. Unlike composing words on a typewriter or computer keyboard, there is no widely taught proper way. If speed is the goal, however, a study of around 37,000 people suggests that one particular approach is better than others. Writing with two thumbs and embracing autocorrect, but avoiding predictive text. That is basically the trick of typing quickly, said Per-Ola Christensen, a professor of interactive systems engineering at the University of Cambridge, and one of the authors of the study, which was presented at Human-Computer Interaction Conference in Taipei on Wednesday. The study focused on the stubbornly persistent QWERTY keyboard, which was originally designed to minimize mechanical typing jams in typewriters. Despite questions about its utility and the emergence of alternate systems, much of the world still relies on the setup. To conduct the study, researchers asked volunteers from around 160 countries to memorize a series of sentences and write them both on desktop keyboards and mobile phones. There has never been another typing study on this scale, according to researchers, but they said that when they compared their findings with smaller studies, the gap in speed between the two devices appeared to be shrinking. When smartphones first came out, people typed about 20 to 25 words per minute, said Anna Feit, a researcher in human-computer interaction at ETH Zurich and another author of the study. Now people average 37 to 40 words per minute, she said. As the authors write in their study, the average person is nearly 70% as fast on a phone as on a laptop. One remarkable typist hit 85 words per minute on a mobile device. Pedro Lopes, a professor of human-computer interaction at the University of Chicago, who is not involved in the study, said the results signaled a paradigm shift. That change is even more evident among young people. On average, subjects between the ages of 10 and 19 were about 10 words per minute faster on smartphones than people in their 40s. One unexpected finding was that a significant number of subjects used a two-finger typing system on full-size computer keyboards. However, they approached typing. Those who used predictive text generally wrote more slowly. Examining word predictions and making a choice is far slower than using autocorrect, Dr. Christensen said. Jack Dennerline, an ergonomics researcher at Northeastern University's Bouvet College of Health Sciences, said the study reinforced what other studies have shown. Two-handed typing is faster than one-handed typing. But the limits on speed involve more than the kind of keyboard or the dexterity of the individual. There is also the element of imagination, said Dr. Christensen, who is an inventor of gesture typing, a swiping technique intended to save time. No matter the system, people cannot exceed 120 words per minute, he said, because they cannot come up with what they're trying to say that quickly. Typing rates are bounded by our creativity, he said. Regardless of speed, most of us are not that original. Half of the words people text are the most frequently used 200 words in English, he said. For our next article, Disney bars Netflix TV ads in battle for streaming supremacy. Dear Netflix, keep your money. That is the message the Walt Disney Company sent by banning advertising from Netflix on its entertainment television networks, principally ABC and Freeform, as it prepares to introduce its own Netflix-style streaming service, Disney+. Disney will continue to accept Netflix ads on its ESPN channels, largely because Netflix does not compete with Disney in sports. The Netflix ban, first reported by the Wall Street Journal, was confirmed by Disney on Friday. In a statement, Disney said it had updated its policy on accepting ads from rival streaming services to reflect the comprehensive business relationships we have with many of these companies. Put more bluntly, Disney does not need Netflix. Netflix does not sell any advertising on its own platform, so Disney has no opportunity to directly advertise Disney Plus to Netflix customers. And Netflix is not embedded within a larger media conglomerate that Disney relies upon for cable distribution. Disney decided not to restrict advertising from HBO Max or Peacock, streaming services from AT&T and Comcast that are set to debut next year. AT&T and Comcast are the two largest cable service providers in the United States. Netflix declined to comment. The streaming service spent about $1.8 billion on advertising last year, about $100 million of which bought ads on television networks, according to iSpot.tv, the advertising measurement firm. About 13% of that $100 million went to Disney-owned entertainment networks. Netflix was a sponsor of last year's Oscars telecast, which ran on ABC. Netflix will likely be part of the next Oscars anyway, with awards prognosticators saying that the streaming giant has no fewer than 3 movies that could figure into the Best Picture race. Television networks have long rejected ads from direct competitors. FX doesn't take ads for HBO shows, for instance. Over the last few years, however, broadcast networks like ABC, CBS, Fox, and NBC have propped up their advertising sales by accepting billions of dollars in advertising from streaming services. During last month's Emmy Awards on Fox, Apple advertised its new streaming dramas and Disney Plus advertised its wares. Netflix used the Emmys to tout El Camino, a new movie based on the AMC series Breaking Bad. But media companies are retreating to their own corners as the so-called streaming wars heat up. Robert A. Iger stepped down from the Apple board last month on the same day that Apple announced that its streaming service, Apple TV Plus, would debut on November 1st and cost $5 a month. Disney Plus, which will cost $7 a month, arrives on November 12th. Disney has also been moving its content off Netflix as it prepares to introduce Disney Plus. Netflix has also lost content from Warner Media, which is behind HBO Max. The direct-to-consumer business has evolved, with many more entrants looking to advertise in traditional television and across our portfolio of networks, Disney said in its statement. For our next article, 10 Tips to Avoid Leaving Tracks Around the Internet. Google and Facebook collect information about us and then sell that data to advertisers. Websites deposit invisible cookies onto our computers and then record where we go online. Even our own government has been known to track us. When it comes to digital privacy, it's easy to feel hopeless. We're mere mortals. We're minuscule molecules in their machines. What power do we possibly have to fight back? That was the question I posed to you, dear readers, in the previous Crowdwise. Many of you responded with valuable but frequently repeated suggestions. Use a program that memorizes your passwords and make every password different. Install an ad blocker in your web browser, like uBlock Origin. Read up on the latest internet scams. If you must use Facebook, visit its privacy settings page and limit its freedom to target ads to you. What I sought, though, was non-obvious ideas. It turns out that digital privacy means different things to different people. Everyone has different concerns, wrote Jamie Winterton, a cybersecurity researcher at Arizona State University. Are you worried about private messaging? Government surveillance? Third-party trackers on the web? Addressing each of these concerns, she noted, requires different tools and techniques. Duck Google. The number one thing that people can do is to stop using Google, wrote privacy consultant Bob Gilman. If you use Gmail and use Google to search the web, Google knows more about you than any other institution. And that goes double if you use other Google services like Google Maps, Waze, Google Docs, etc. Like many other readers, he recommended DuckDuckGo, a rival web search engine. Its search results often aren't as useful as Google's, but it's advertised not to track you or your searches. And if you don't use Gmail for email, what should you use? I'm a huge advocate for paying for your email account, wrote Russian journalist Yuri Litvinenko. It's not about turning off ads, but giving your email providers as little incentive to peek into your inbox as possible. ProtonMail, for example, costs $4 a month and offers a host of privacy features, including anonymous signup and end-to-end encryption. Jam Google. The ads you see online are based on the sites, searches, or Facebook posts that get your interest. Some rebels, therefore, throw a wrench into the machinery by demonstrating phony interests. Every once in a while, I Google something completely nutty just to mess with their algorithm, wrote Sean Breitbart. You'd be surprised what sort of coupons CVS prints for me on the bottom of my receipt. They are clearly confused about both my age and my gender. It's akin to radio jamming, noted Frank Piano. It does make for some interesting browsing, as ads for items we searched for follow us around like puppy dogs. Barry Joseph uses a similar tactic when registering for an account on a new website. I often switch my gender, which delivers ads less relevant to me, although I must admit the bra advertising can be distracting. He notes that there are side effects. My friends occasionally get gendered notifications about me, such as wish her a happy birthday. But even that is a plus, leading to interesting conversations about gender norms and expectations. Avoid unnecessary web tracking. It's perfectly legitimate, by the way, to enjoy seeing ads that align with your interests. You could argue that they're actually more useful than irrelevant ones. But millions of others are creeped out by the tracking that produces these targeted ads. If you're in that category, Miss Winterton recommended Ghostery, a free plugin for most web browsers that blocks the trackers and lists them by category, she wrote. Some sites have an amazing number of trackers whose only purpose is to record your behavior, sometimes across multiple sites, and pitch better advertisements. Be careful on public Wi-Fi. Most public Wi-Fi networks in hotels, airports, coffee shops, and so on are eavesdroppable, even if they require a password to connect. Nearby patrons, using their phones or laptops, can easily see everything you're sending or receiving. Email and website contents, for example, using free sniffer programs. You don't have to worry social, WhatsApp, and Apple's iMessages, all of which encrypt your messages before they even leave your phone or laptop. Using websites whose addresses begin with HTTPS are also safe. They too encrypt their data before it's sent to your browser, and vice versa. Caution: even if the site's address begins with HTTPS, the bad guys can still see which sites you visit. They just can't see what you do there once you're connected. The solution, as recommended by Lauren Todman and others, a virtual private network program. These phone and computer apps encrypt everything you send or receive, and, as a bonus, mask your location. Wirecutter's favorite VPN, TunnelBear, is available for Windows, Mac, Android, and iOS. It's free for up to 500 megabytes a month, or $60 a year for up to 5 devices. Use Apple. I don't like Apple's phones, their operating systems, or their looks, wrote Aaron Soyce, but the one thing Apple gets right is valuing your data security. Purely in terms of data, Apple serves you, and Google serves you to the sharks. Apple's privacy website reveals many examples. You don't sign into Apple Maps or Safari, so your searches and trips aren't linked to you. Safari's Don't Track Me features are turned on as the factory setting. When you buy something with Apple Pay, Apple receives no information about the item, the store, or the price. Apple can afford to tout these features, explained software developer Joel Podishman, because it's a hardware company. Its business model depends on us giving them our money. Google and Facebook make their money by selling our info to other people. Don't sign in with Facebook. Mr. Podishman never registers with a new website using the sign in with Facebook or sign in with Google shortcut buttons. They allow those companies to track you on other sites, he wrote. Instead, he registers the long way with an email address and password. And here's Apple again. The sign in with Apple button, new and not yet incorporated by many websites, is designed to offer the same one-click convenience, but with a promise not to track or profile you. Identity theft from a pro. My call for submissions drew some tips from a surprising respondent. Frank Abagnale, the former teenage con artist who was the subject of the 2002 movie Catch Me If You Can. After his prison time, he began working for the FBI, giving talks on scam protection and writing books. He's donating all earnings from his latest book, Scam Me If You Can, to the AARP in support of its efforts to educate older Americans about internet ripoffs. His advice? You never want to tell Facebook where you were born and your date of birth. That's 98% of someone stealing your identity. And don't use a straight-on photo of yourself, like a passport photo, driver's license, or graduation photo that someone can use on a fake ID. Mr. Abagnale also notes that you should avoid sharing your personal data offline, too. We give a lot of information away, not just on social media, but places we go where people automatically ask us all of these questions. What magazines do you read? What's your job? Do you earn between this and that amount of money? Why answer if you don't have to? The lightning round. A few more suggestions. Create a different email address for every service you use, wrote Matt McHenry. Then you can tell which one has shared your info and create filters to silence them if necessary. Apps like Privacy and Token Virtual generate a disposable credit card number with each purchase, so in case of a breach, your actual card isn't compromised, suggested Juan Garrido. Bill Barnes agreed, pointing out the similar ShopSafe service offered from Bank of America's Visa cards. Your advertisers won't like to see this, so perhaps you won't print it, predicted Betsy Pito, but I avoid using apps on my cell phone as much as possible. Instead, I go to the associated website in my phone's browser. For example, www.dailybeast.com. My data is still tracked there, but not as much as it would be by the app. There is some good news. Tech companies are beginning to feel some pressure. In 2017, the European Union passed the General Data Protection Regulation, GDPR, which requires companies to explain what data they're collecting, and to offer the option to edit or delete it. China, India, Japan, Brazil, South Korea, and Thailand have passed or are considering similar laws, and California's Consumer Privacy Act takes effect on January 1st. In the meantime, enjoy these suggestions, as well as this bonus tip from privacy researcher Jamie Winterton. Oh yeah, and don't use Facebook. And for our final article, Snapchat's Disappearing Act leaves Venice Beach searching for its future. Snaps changed social media in Venice, California for good. What's next? For a lot of Venice diehards, the thing that irked them most about Snapchat was the security guards. When the company behind the Disappearing Messages app took over multiple properties on the beach as it expanded, starting in 2012, it also posted guards who would shoo away anyone who wasn't an employee and who lingered too long near a Snapchat entrance. In an oceanfront community still defined by hippie eccentricity, that didn't go over well. They were not particularly good neighbors, said Fran Solomon, a raspy-voiced four-decade resident of Venice who was a member of the original Venice Community Council. I understand the need for security, but it was not the gestalt of the area, if you know what I mean. This counterculture mecca on the Pacific Ocean has always attracted freethinkers and visionaries. Look at Abbot Kinney, the developer who bought much of the area in 1905 to create a Venice in America. He transformed a marshy plot of land into a veritable Coney Island of the West Coast, wooing crowds with dance halls, canals, amusement rides, and a saltwater plunge. Or consider the beatniks and hippies. The post-war anything-goes vibe in Venice eventually gave birth to skate and surf cultures, producing worldwide legends in those crafts, including the skater Stacy Peralta and the surfer Jeff Ho. Or for that matter, look at the guys who invented Snapchat. Bit by bit, Snap Inc., as the company is now known, was built into a multi-billion dollar enterprise, resulting in the biggest IPO in Los Angeles history, right here in Venice. The story of its rise was the toast of Silicon Beach in Los Angeles. The city is now the third largest tech hub on the West Coast, after San Francisco and Seattle, with, according to a report by the real estate firm CBRE, nearly 140,000 people working in tech. Along the way, Google, BuzzFeed, Vice, and other tech and media companies planted flags in Venice. But none made a bigger imprint here than Snap, which championed an independent narrative by persistently fighting off acquisition attempts. Market Street in Venice, just steps from the beach, used to be Snap's headquarters. Today, four lease signs dangle from the roof lines. The security guards are gone. It's been a year since Snap decamped from its many storefront offices scattered across the area. Seeking to centralize operations, it moved most of its employees, about 2,700, to a corporate campus in Santa Monica. On Market Street, all that remains of Snap's former presence are closed-up windows and glazed-over windows that once shrouded whatever happened inside. Homeless encampments have sprouted on the sidewalk. Miss Solomon, 70, runs a Venice Beach walking tour business with her husband, Jeff. They have spent the past few years telling tourists, this used to be, that used to be, about Snap's once restless physical expansion, she said. But with Snap's exodus, what comes next?